Killinalec is one of the smallest towns in County Cavan. It's one of the smallest towns in Ireland. On a Saturday morning, it's a quiet place and peaceful. On the Saturday morning of June 28, 2014, Gardaí and Killinalec arrive at a house on Main Street. The old post, as it's known. It was once the post office, but now it's a small home. They climb the stairs and make their way to the bedroom. In there, in the ensuite bathroom, they find her, Antra Ozelina, just as they were told they would. Beside her, they see an empty bottle of vodka, a Bible, and a blue nylon rope. It seems clear what has happened here. This is suicide. The doctor who arrives at the scene soon after agrees. Antra has taken her own life. And that's it. But sometimes first impressions can be deceptive. You might not take it all in. And when you take a second look, the evidence before your eyes can start to tell a very different story. When someone is murdered in Ireland, the Gardaí call in a team of forensic scenes of crime examiners from the Technical Bureau. And for 25 years, I was part of that team. My name is John Sweetman. I was there to read the silent and often hidden clues at a crime scene. I saw what killers tried to hide. Fingerprints left behind. Weapons concealed in plain sight. Handwriting that betrayed a lie. Every detail mattered. Every detail told the real story. Now I'm telling you those stories. As a new year begins, welcome to Lines of Inquiry. In this Go Loud original podcast, I take you inside some of Ireland's most haunting crimes, looking beyond the headlines, following the evidence step by step, and uncovering what investigations really reveal. If you are hearing us for the first time, I would encourage you to go back and start at episode 1. In this episode, the death of Antra Ozelina, found in her home on a quiet street in a rural County Cavan village, and why what looked like a suicide would later raise questions Gardaí could not ignore. Killinalec, County Cavan, is a tiny village of about 400 people. It's surrounded by green fields and quiet lanes. It's a small place, much smaller than the nearby market towns of Ballyjamesduff and Virginia. It's a simple place surrounded by farmland and back roads, where little changes and everyone tends to know one another. It is the quiet kind of place where it can seem nothing of note happens. People go on quietly with their lives, trying to make the best living for themselves and their families. By the mid-2000s, Ireland's economic boom had drawn many newcomers to the country, and although many of those people settled in the major cities, a few ventured to the small, quiet rural corners like Killinalec. One of them was Antra Ozelina, who arrived from Latvia in 2004 seeking better opportunities for herself and her family, and would make Killinalec her home. Antra was 49 years old in 2014. She was a divorced mother of one grown daughter, Eudiga. By all accounts, she was a happy, outgoing woman with an infectious laugh. She worked hard and cared deeply for her loved ones. While forging her new life in Ireland, Antra ensured she maintained her ties to home. She sent money back to Latvia every month and visited her daughter whenever she could. The 3,000-kilometre distance didn't dull the bond between mother and daughter. Antra settled into the Killinalec community, taking a job at Breffni Mushrooms, a local mushroom farm just over 1 kilometre from her house. Closed-cup mushrooms, large flat mushrooms, chestnut mushrooms, portobello mushrooms, and button mushrooms were all harvested on the family-owned farm, which had been in business for over 40 years outside the village. It was a big employer for the local area. Antra had spent nearly a decade picking and processing mushrooms and was well-liked. Her co-workers saw her as a happy, warm and dedicated member of the team. She worked her 40 hours a week and, in those 10 years, she never missed one day of work. It was tough, modest work, but she took pride in earning her living honestly. Antra found her home at the small rented cottage on Main Street, known as the Old Post, a simple two-story house that had once been the village post office before it was replaced by a new one. That post office since closed down. A sign of the times in rural Ireland. In that cosy home, she was earning her living and life was straightforward. She wasn't the only Latvian to settle in the rural village, and many of them also worked picking mushrooms at the Breffni farm. As the Irish summer approached its height, Antra seemed to have a lot to look forward to. On the 20th of June, she had taken a small personal loan of €500 to help cover the cost of a trip home to see her daughter in Latvia in the coming weeks. Antra wasn't living alone at the Old Post on Main Street. She shared it with a woman named Agita Janmaize, a 34-year-old fellow Latvian. Agita was a single mother herself and had come to Ireland as well, finding work in the same mushroom farm as Antra. Despite an age gap of 15 years, the two women got on well. Antra treated Agita almost like a younger sister, looking out for her and trying to support her. Agita found stability and friendship under Antra's roof. To outsiders, they appeared to be close friends, helping each other make a life in a foreign land, working hard and earning a living together at the fungi farm, while Antra was trying to help support her family back home in Eastern Europe. On June 26th, Antra spoke with her daughter, Judiga. Judiga would later remember her mother seemed to be in good form. The following day, on Friday, June 27th, after the week's work had finished, Antra returned to her home on the main street in Killilleck. It could be safe to presume it was a Friday evening like any other. It had rained earlier in the day, but that had cleared, and the summer sunshine would have stretched long into the evening. The following morning, a call came in to the local Garda station. The caller said that there had been an event in a nearby home. He and others wanted to visit the station to report it. A short while later, a young man named Gunnar Zasikis arrived at the station along with Agita Janmaize, Antra's housemate. Gunnar's was just a teenager, 16 or 17, and was there to translate for Agita. Garda Arthur O'Connor was amongst those there who heard a tragic story unfold. Agita explained that she had woken that morning and gone to the bathroom to find her housemate dead, with a rope around her neck. Sometime that same morning, someone called the phone of Antra's daughter, Judiga. It was from an unknown number. A man on the other end of the line told her, coldly, that her mother had killed herself. He refused to give his name and added strangely, "Don't worry too much. The same thing happened to my father." Following their visit to the Garda station, Garda O'Connor accompanied Agita and Gunnar's back to the Old Post. Garda O'Connor was led upstairs to an ensuite bathroom off one of the bedrooms. As he approached the doorway, he could see two feet on the floor. The feet were a pale shade of blue. Inside, Antra Ozelina lay slumped just inside the bathroom door. She was wearing grey trousers and a pink jumper. A blue nylon rope was around her neck. The rope wasn't attached to anything. Her face was blue and swollen. Garda O'Connor checked her for signs of life. There was no pulse. A nearly empty bottle of Smirnoff vodka lay on the floor beside her. A Bible prayer book was nearby. A towel rail was fixed to the wall, with no towel hanging from it. A metal rod rested on top of the shower unit. There was a small amount of blood in the shower tray, though it was not immediately clear where or who it had come from. At first glance, there were no obvious signs of a struggle. No overturned furniture. No visible injuries beyond the mark around the deceased's neck. To Garda O'Connor, the scene appeared consistent with suicide. A local doctor arrived at the house and, acting as a coroner's assistant, carried out an initial examination on Antra. That early assessment aligned with the Garda view. A case of a tragic suicide. Returning downstairs, Garda O'Connor spoke with Igita to gather more details about her housemate's death. She told him that she and Antra had argued verbally the previous night. She said they were the only two people in the house at the time. The following morning, at around 8:40 a.m., she said she went into Antra's bedroom and found her with a rope around her neck. She said it was not attached to anything when she found her. She then said she went to Gunnar's to get help. In that initial stage, the authorities' view was that Antra had taken her own life. Antra's body was removed for a standard post-mortem at Our Lady's Hospital in Navan, and Gardaí began taking statements from those who found her. As word spread in the small town, there was shock. And for many who knew Antra, there was disbelief. Some wondered how she could have taken her own life. She seemed happy. She seemed strong. The outer face of someone, of course, can often hide much. But to those who knew Antra well, it felt completely unfathomable. In the days after Antra's death, Gardaí got a call from one of those people, Antra's employer, Eugene Kernan, the owner of Breffni Mushrooms. He told Detective Garda James McDevitt that a suicide simply didn't seem likely. She was very happy, and she had plans to return to Latvia for a trip shortly. It just didn't add up. Detective Garda McDevitt listened to Eugene, and after speaking to him, decided to pass the information up the chain to the superintendent, Jim Cohn. Very quickly, the decision was made that they needed to take a closer second look at the death of Antra Ozolina. Gardaí had initially believed Antra Ozolina had died by suicide, but after speaking with some people who knew her well, and hearing how unlikely it seemed to them that she would take her own life, they decided the case warranted a second, closer look. Gardaí requested a second autopsy, this time to be conducted by a forensic pathologist. The original doctor who attended the scene had not been trained in forensic pathology, and would not necessarily have had the specific experience needed to spot any small signs that could have hinted at a crime. Now, with foul play suspected, it was important that a follow-up examination was conducted by a forensic pathologist. This second autopsy was carried out by Deputy State Pathologist Dr. Michael Curtis. Dr. Curtis's examination would change everything. Unlike the local examiner, Dr. Curtis specialized in reading the silent story a body can tell. He found that Antra had sustained multiple blunt force injuries to her head and face, injuries that were not explained by a hanging scenario. These bruises and contusions suggested Antra had been the victim of a violent assault. This meant she had been struck before death, a struggle that the original scene had not revealed. The nylon rope had left a mark, but the pattern and depth didn't match a hanging where the weight of the body causes a distinct ligature furrow. These findings were the first incontrovertible sign that Gardaí were dealing with a homicide, cleverly staged as a suicide. There was more, as Dr. Curtis concluded that Antra's true cause of death was asphyxia due to neck compression. In other words, she was strangled, not by the rope around her neck, but more likely by someone's hands. With this information, Gardaí returned to the old post on the main street of Killinalek. There, they took a long look at the scene of the supposed suicide. If Antra had been murdered, the blue nylon rope, prayer book, empty vodka bottle and other items were now pieces of a puzzle. The rope around Antra's neck wasn't tied to anything. When she was found, she wasn't hanging from the shower rail or a hook. The rope was simply looped loosely, which was unusual. And looking back at it with a more critical eye, maybe that prayer book and bottle felt almost too perfectly placed. Gardaí brought in an engineer to examine the bathroom fixtures. He determined that the shower rail in Antra's bathroom was the only plausible attachment point for a hanging. Yet the rail was flimsy, and when they put that together with the 7mm rope, it became apparent that the two together couldn't support the weight of a grown woman. The engineer's reconstruction reinforced what the autopsy showed. Detectives began dismantling the suicide scene, piece by piece. Antra had not died by hanging at all. The rope around her neck was purely cosmetic, a cruel instrument of deception, designed to cover the tracks of the killer and heap more misery on a grieving family. This revelation turned the case on its head. Gardaí now formally launched a murder investigation. The quiet village of Killinalec woke up to the news that Antra Ozzolina's death was not the tragic suicide that they'd been led to believe, but an act of brutal violence. For the community, shock mingled with a grim validation of suspicions held by those who knew Antra's character. The Garda team, including detectives from Cavan and specialists from the Garda Technical Bureau, descended on the house to gather any evidence that may initially have been overlooked. Forensic detectives scored every inch of the bathroom and bedroom for fingerprints, DNA, trawling for any small sign of a struggle, or anything else that could help fill in the gaps in this story. They found little. But based off what they now knew, Gardaí had a theory. Antra had been killed by someone known to her. Attention now turned to Antra's housemate, the woman who had reported finding her body, Agita Yanmaize. They also learned Agita was not the only person who lived with Antra. Agita was in a relationship with a man named Roman Ponomarcus, and he spent a lot of time at the home with Agita. Gardaí had initially not met Roman. He had not come to the Garda station with Agita and Gunnars to report the discovery of Antra's body, and Agita had not mentioned him in any of her statements so far to Gardaí. She had told them she and Antra were the only people in the home that night. It appears that at that time, Gardaí did not know a lot about Roman Ponomarcus. But as time went on, they would learn much more, both about his life in Ireland and a dark past in his native Latvia. Investigators examined Antra's phone records and found she had called someone on the fateful evening. It transpired it was a friend in Latvia who told Gardaí that during that call, Antra had said that she was afraid and was going to call the guards. As Gardaí learned more, they deepened their investigation. They put a closer eye on the couple who had lived with Antra at the old post. As they did, they found several critical pieces of information falling into place. One person who would prove crucial to it all was Gunnars Asikis. It was Gunnars who had accompanied Agita to the Garda station on that Saturday morning to report the death at her home. Gunnars had been there to translate, and not much more. But as Gardaí spoke to him again, it became apparent Gunnars had a lot more to tell them. Gunnars told them that on that Friday evening, Agita and Roman had visited him. He lived with his mother and sister in Killinalec. His mother worked at the same mushroom factory where Antra worked. Agita and Roman had arrived at Gunnar's home, and it was clear that they had already been drinking. They continued drinking once there, and as the night wore on, the mood soured. According to Gunnar's, Agita and Roman got into an argument in his front room. It wasn't clear to Gunnar's what the couple were fighting about, but Gunnar's was relieved when at last they left. By the time they made their way out of Gunnar's house late that night, Agita was so drunk that she could barely walk, while Roman, though drunk, was still on his feet and angry about something. Gunnar's watched the pair stagger into the night. It seems they arrived back at the old post on Main Street not long after. Gunnar's saw them again early the following morning. At about 8 a.m. the next morning on June 28, Agita and Roman arrived at his door again. He told Gardaí that he immediately sensed something was off. He felt Agita and Roman were acting strangely. Roman told Gunnars that Antra was dead. She had killed herself, he said. They told Gunnar's that Igita had woke that morning and seen a light on in Antra's bathroom. They told Gunnar's that there they had found Antra's body. Roman had pressed Gunnar's not to call the Gardaí. Gunnar's was afraid of Roman, and in the moment went along with his wishes. But nothing about it felt right to him. Over the next few minutes on that Saturday morning, Igita and Roman spun their story to Gunnar's. He was told that all three of them who lived at their home, Antra, Igita and Roman, had been drinking together. They said Igita went to bed, and when she woke in the morning she noticed the bathroom light on and discovered Antra's body. Roman claimed he then checked the bathroom himself, saw Antra's body and the rope confirming the suicide. They repeatedly told Gunnar's that Antra must have done this to herself while they slept. Gunnar's listened, but he grew increasingly suspicious. He noticed Igita and Roman kept stepping out of the room to chat privately. They did it at least three times. He also noticed something else unusual. Roman was carrying a wallet bulging with a large amount of cash that morning. It didn't seem to fit that Roman would have that kind of cash normally. Then Roman pressed Gunnar's into an even tighter spot. He told him what to tell Gardaí when he visited the station. Roman would not be going in to talk to Gardaí. Roman also pushed Gunnar's to give Gardaí the impression that he, Roman, was not a regular presence in Antra's house, and to tell them that he lived in Dublin, only visiting Killinalec once a week. It was a request which only increased Gunnar's unease. Gunnar's told Gardaí that he and Igita had then gone to the Garda station, where he had been too afraid to be fully honest with them. The reason for that, he told them, was that Roman was waiting outside the station. In her first statements, Igita hadn't mentioned any third person present that night. But now detectives, with the mounting evidence, strongly suspected that Agita's account to that point had been incomplete and possibly a lie to cover for the killer. The Gardaí did their homework on Roman's background. They gathered intelligence from Latvian authorities and it sketched a disturbing picture. Roman Ponomarkus was no stranger to violence or hate. He had prior convictions in Latvia for racially motivated offences. He was indeed a self-professed neo-Nazi, and he bore a swastika tattoo on his chest. He also had a track record of attacking people of other ethnicities. They also discovered he'd committed armed robberies in his past, including one involving a gun and others with knives. He was supposed to be under supervised release back in Latvia for those crimes, but ran away to Ireland, violating his parole conditions, which resulted in the issuing of a European arrest warrant for him. Roman was effectively already an international fugitive when he arrived in Ireland, sometime late in 2013. It soon became apparent that he had continued in the same vein once he had arrived in Ireland. During the investigation, Gardaí uncovered a statement from another woman that shocked them. Roman had assaulted a female acquaintance in Cavan, choking her as well. This woman had apparently insulted Roman, calling him a derogatory name, implying that he was homosexual, and Roman responded by grabbing her throat in a rage. In another incident, one of Antra's co-workers at the mushroom farm, a woman named Gundega Beliscanye, had an unsettling encounter with Roman in May 2014. It was a little less than a month before Antra's death. Gundega said that while visiting Agita's house, Roman suddenly began harassing her because she was dating a black man. When the confrontation escalated, Roman grew enraged and grabbed Gundega by the throat. As she struggled, he menacingly bragged that he had killed 7 people. He told her he felt no remorse. Gundega managed to get out of the house, shaken and frightened. With it all falling together, Gardaí brought Igita in for further questioning. In contrast to their previous conversations, they now had a wealth of evidence to put to her. They had the statement from the friend who spoke to Antra on the phone that night. They had Gunnar's recollections of that morning, and most importantly, they had the critical evidence from the second autopsy and the second crime scene investigation. Confronted with mounting evidence, her story began to crumble. Gardaí played a delicate game, understanding that Agita herself might be under duress from Roman. They interviewed her multiple times. At first, Agita stuck rigidly to the suicide story. She suggested that Antra may have been depressed or drinking heavily. Later, when Gardaí outlined the injuries uncovered during the postmortem, she speculated that Antra might somehow have caused them herself, in what she described as a kind of suicidal frenzy. But as Gardaí laid out the facts they had gathered, Agita finally started to waver. After hours of questioning, she broke down and admitted to an entirely different version of events. She explained to them that, sometime in the darkness of the early morning, the tensions in that little house on Main Street erupted. A furious argument had turned deadly. She alleged that in a sudden burst of rage, Roman had lunged at Antra. He wrapped his muscular arm around her neck in a tight chokehold. Antra, caught off guard, struggled desperately as he squeezed. Agita, despite her drunken state, claimed she tried to intervene, saying she pushed at Roman, trying to pry him off Antra. But Roman was younger, stronger, and white hot with anger. He punched Agita hard in the stomach to keep her back, then continued choking Antra until her body went limp. In a matter of moments, Antra Ozzolina's life was brutally taken. She had been strangled to death by a man she barely knew in her own home, a man she had feared might do exactly this. Agita stood by, shocked and horrified. She later told Gardaí that when she threatened to run for help, Roman turned on her, grabbing her by the throat and snarling that he would kill her too if she breathed a word of what he had done. Becoming visibly emotional now, Agita explained that Roman then forced her to stage the suicide by placing the rope around Antra's neck. She told Gardaí she did as he instructed because she truly believed Roman would kill her next if she disobeyed. Agita even demonstrated what she had done. One of the Gardaí lay on the interview room floor while she showed how she had placed the nylon rope around Antra's neck. At last, Gardaí had a clear picture of what had happened the night Antra died. Roman Ponomarchus strangled Antra. Agita Yaonmaise, under threat, assisted in the cover-up. Armed with Agita's statements, detectives moved to apprehend Roman. They didn't have to look far. Roman was still lurking about in Cavan. In the weeks following Antra's death, Roman seemingly kept a low profile, but didn't flee the country. And when Gardaí brought him in for questioning, not long after Agita's partial confession, he seemed unfazed. He was 30 years old at this time, and when Gardaí sat him down in the interview room, they encountered a man who was disturbingly calm for a murder suspect. One detective later described his demeanour as brazen. Roman smirked through the interview and denied everything. With chilling arrogance, he told investigators that if he'd killed someone, he'd hardly be telling them. Maybe Roman knew Gardaí didn't have all they needed to charge him. Maybe he knew it all hinged on Agita's word. Whatever he knew or thought he knew, he stuck to his story. He maintained that he wasn't even there that night, exactly as he'd coached Agita to say. Gardaí knew that, despite the mounting circumstantial and character evidence, building a murder case to stand up in court would be challenging. The forensic evidence showed Antra was murdered, but it didn't directly identify who had killed her. Agita's testimony was crucial, but as an accomplice, she was vulnerable on the stand. Her credibility could easily be attacked by Roman's defence, especially since she had lied initially in her statements. A changing story would not fare well in court. The Gardaí and the DPP had to decide how to pursue justice. Would they charge Agita, Roman, or both? Ideally, they wanted to charge Roman Ponomarchus with murder and Agita Yalmaize with any lesser offences arising from the cover-up. While Agita was a cooperative witness, there was always the risk that any change of heart could cause the largely circumstantial case against Roman to collapse. Roman remained free, albeit under close Garda surveillance. Agita too returned to her normal life after her admissions, while the Gardaí and DPP decided their next move. Gardaí treated her carefully, possibly hoping she'd testify against Roman. They even offered Agita a form of refuge, with an offer of accommodation with St. Vincent de Paul, to allow her to get away from Roman and stay safe while the investigation continued. They understood that she might be a victim too, as well as an offender. The Gardaí were careful to include a written record of this offer in the custody record and asked Agita to sign it. She did so, but did not accept the offer of safe haven. Despite saying she had helped to cover up the murder in fear of her own life and the terror that Roman might kill her next, having watched him strangle her housemate, she returned to Roman's side almost immediately after her initial release. That day, investigators observed Agita back in his company just days later. It was a baffling, disheartening turn for Gardaí, but it is all too common in abusive dynamics. Gardaí realised that getting Agita to testify freely against Roman might be harder than expected. As the investigation closed in, the Gardaí narrowed their focus to a single man. The case appeared to be reaching its conclusion. But before any charge could be brought by the DPP, everything changed. On October 29th, 2014, the investigation was overtaken by events no one had seen coming, as Roman's recklessness and tendency for violence took a devastating turn. That day, Roman Ponomarcus set in course a series of events that would redefine his life and completely change the Garda investigation into the death of Antra Ozzolina. He had spent the afternoon drinking brandy with a friend. They concocted a plan in a haze of intoxication, and just before 6 p.m, they left the apartment to carry it out. They planned to violently rob an innocent victim. Anyone would do, it seemed. They targeted a local businesswoman in County Longford. Lying in wait, wearing balaclavas, the two men ambushed the woman, Sabrina Sense, as she returned to her Mercedes car in the Heaton's car park on Ballymahon Street in Longford. They held her at knife point, forced her into the back seat of her own car, and sped off. Roman, with the same cruel brutality Garda had gleaned about his character in witness statements, shoved Sabrina into the car with a crude order. "Get in, bitch." Once inside the car, Roman pressed his leg against Sabrina's neck to keep her subdued in the back seat. His accomplice took the wheel and they sped off. But unknown to the carjackers, they were seen in the car park as they attacked Sabrina Sense. Gardaí were alerted quickly enough that they could view CCTV footage of the unfolding incident before racing to a patrol car to give chase. The pursuing Gardaí made several attempts to force the Mercedes to stop, but to no avail. It was chaos, and it was about to end in a brutal fashion. Just over 3 months after Antra's death, Gardaí had reached her final conclusion about the case. Antra Ozzolina had not taken her own life. She had been murdered. The suicide scene in the bathroom of her home in Killinalec had been carefully staged. The investigation had narrowed to one man, but Gardaí and the DPP needed more if they were to hold him accountable for his crimes. The weeks turned into months, and progress on the case slowed. By the end of October, no one was charged for Antra Ozzolina's murder. Yet. Gardaí were convinced Roman Ponomarcus was responsible for the murder, but he seemed to be slipping through their fingers. On October 29th, he and an accomplice ambushed a woman getting into her car in an attempted robbery. They bundled her into the car and sped off. As they raced through the outskirts of Longford town with Garda cars on their tail, the driver lost control of the Mercedes. The hijacked car hit a ditch at high speed before crashing. Roman Ponomarchus and the other attacker fled the car. The victim, Sabrina Sense, was badly shaken and suffered minor physical injuries in the ordeal, which had lasted for around 30 minutes. She later spoke about how the attack had left her living a life plagued by anxiety and panic attacks, to the point she had to give up working. In the confusion after the crash, Roman Ponomarchus flung open the door and ran. As he sprinted down the road away from the crashed Mercedes he'd carjacked with his friend, a passing car, unable to stop in time, smashed into Roman at 60 kilometers per hour. The bone-shattering impact was brutal. Roman was thrown into the air and was left in a crumpled heap on the road, catastrophically injured. By the time Gardaí reached him, the fearsome brute, the prime suspect in the murder of Antra Ozzolina, was in a sorry state on death's door. Unconscious, having suffered a traumatic brain injury, multiple fractures and damage to his spinal cord, he was barely clinging to life. He was rushed to Beaumont Hospital in Dublin in critical condition, with doctors unsure if he'd survive. Roman lay comatose in intensive care for months. Slowly, he stabilised enough to be moved to a long-term care facility, but the prognosis was dire. Roman Ponomarchus had lost the use of three of his four limbs. He could no longer speak or move independently, and had such limited brain function that he at first needed to be fed through a tube. Later he could manage being spoon-fed, but he remained essentially non-verbal and bedridden, needing a hoist to be lifted in and out of the bed each day. In one violent swoop, the man who had murdered Antra Ozzolina was rendered permanently incapacitated, beyond the reach of any courtroom justice. Gardaí kept monitoring his progress, hopeful at first that if he recovered enough, they could charge him. But the reality set in. Roman would never stand trial for Antra's killing. He was physically alive, yet effectively locked in a prison of his own shattered body and mind. Investigators now turned their attention back to Agita. In the wake of Roman's accident, Agita presented herself at the Garda station in Longford and told officers, "I know now I can't help him. I can't change him. I'm tired of trying to help him." Agita finally separated herself from Roman. From that point on, Agita cooperated fully with authorities. She reaffirmed her earlier statements that Roman had killed Antra and that she had only acted out of fear. But cooperation could not absolve her of her own crimes. By staging Antra's suicide and lying to Gardaí, Agita Yanmoise had impeded the investigation of a murder. It is a serious crime under Irish law. The Director of Public Prosecutions weighed the evidence and decided to charge Agita for her role in the killing of Antra. In February 2017, Agita, then 34, was formally charged with impeding the apprehension or prosecution of a person, knowing or believing that person to be guilty of murder. The charge specifically named Roman Ponomarchus as the murderer she sought to protect. In essence, even though Roman couldn't be put on trial, he would be named as such in court, and the justice system would hold Agita accountable for trying to shield him. Agita pleaded not guilty, not because she denied her actions, but because she claimed she had a reasonable excuse for them, that she was under duress and in fear for her life. This would set the stage for a trial where the jury had to decide if Agita was a victim, a culprit, or a mix of both. Inside the courtroom, details unfolded of a story about abuse, a staged suicide, a brutal neo-Nazi, and a murder case with no murderer present. Prosecutor Patrick Gage BSC opened by making it clear to the jury that Antra Ozzolina had been murdered. That fact was not in dispute. What was at issue was Agita's intent and state of mind when she staged the suicide. Did she have reasonable excuse for what she did? Was she acting under duress from a violent partner, or had she willingly chosen to mislead Gardaí? These were the questions facing the jury of seven men and five women. Over 2 weeks of testimony, The court heard from a wide range of witnesses who gave their version of events of June 2014. Antra's daughter, Jadwiga Kreisler, gave evidence via video link from Latvia. She described her mother as a happy, healthy woman with no history of mental illness. She recalled that cheerful phone call they shared just days before Antra's death and said the idea of suicide was unimaginable to her. Jadwiga also recounted that deeply unsettling call the morning after her mother died, when an unidentified man had called to let her know that her mother had killed herself. She told the court she believed the person on the other end of that line was Roman. Friends of Antra also took to the stand. Gunta Kislina described Antra as lively and optimistic, not someone prone to depression. Gundega Bieliskanje described a chilling encounter with Roman Ponomarkas in May 2014, when he became enraged over her dating a black man, grabbing her by the throat and boasting that he had killed 7 people, showing no remorse. The courtroom reacted with audible shock as she recounted his words. Through this evidence, the jury heard repeated descriptions of Roman as a dangerous, violent and intimidating presence. Gundega also told the court that Antra treated Agita like a daughter and would stand up for her. Gunnar Zasikis testified, speaking about the night of the 27th and the morning of the 28th, when Roman and Agita visited his home, first drinking until they stumbled home, the second time to pressure him into going to the Garda station and telling their version of events. Forensic witnesses then outlined how the suicide scene had been dismantled piece by piece, including Deputy State Pathologist Dr. Michael Curtis, who outlined the cause of death. The engineer gave evidence that the shower rail could not have supported Antra's weight, debunking the suicide scenario entirely. When the defense case began, the facts of the murder and the staging were not disputed. Instead, the defense presented Agita as another victim of Roman Ponomarkas. A psychiatrist testified about Agita's psychological state. The doctor told the court that Agita had a history of trauma. She was a victim of a violent crime as a child, leaving her with PTSD. This condition, he explained, made her especially susceptible to re-victimization, meaning she tended to fall into abusive relationships repeatedly. In the psychiatrist's expert opinion, Agita would have had limited ability to defy such a dominating, threatening, physically and psychologically abusive man as Roman. Essentially, the defense argued that Agita was trapped in an abusive, coercive control situation, and on the night of the murder, she reasonably feared that disobeying Roman would result in her own death. Agita herself testified, her voice trembling as she took the stand and recounted the night Antra died. She told the jury that Roman had grabbed her by the throat and threatened to kill her if she went to Gardaí. She described the terror of being forced to wrap a rope around her friend's neck, saying it was an act she carried out only because she believed her own life was in immediate danger. Under cross-examination, prosecutors pressed her on the inconsistencies in her account. Why had she continued to lie in voluntary statements even when Roman was not present? Why had she returned to him if she was so afraid? Agita broke down as she tried to answer. She admitted that she had initially lied not only out of fear that Roman would kill her, but also because she was afraid of him being sent back to Latvia. She said he had told her horrifying stories about what awaited him if he were returned, and that she wanted to protect him, even after everything he'd done. She also tearfully acknowledged that returning to Roman was a terrible mistake, one she attributed to the hold he had over her and the twisted loyalty that often characterizes abusive relationships. Her defense counsel later echoed that theme, telling the jury that she was guilty of going back to a bad man, and asked them to consider what they themselves might have done in her position that night. In closing arguments, prosecutor Patrick Gageby argued that regardless of her motives, Agita's actions had impeded justice. By staging a suicide, She delayed a murder investigation and risked allowing a killer to remain free. He emphasized that once the immediate threat had passed, Agueda had opportunities to tell the truth, but chose not to do so until circumstances forced her hand. The prosecution highlighted the gravity of Antra's family's loss and how the initial deception had almost denied them the truth about how she died. For the defence, Giolisa Olieda urged the jury to see Agueda as one of life's victims. He said she was guilty of poor judgment in love, not of being a criminal mastermind. He asked jurors to consider the legal defences of duress and reasonable excuse, arguing that if they believed Agueda acted under an immediate threat of death or serious harm, they were entitled to acquit her. He reminded them that Antra herself had treated Agueda like a daughter and would not have wanted her punished, appealing directly to the jury's sense of mercy. After nearly 2 weeks of testimony, the jury retired to deliberate. They spent more than 3.5 hours weighing Agueda's fear against her actions. When they returned, they delivered a majority verdict of guilty by 11-1. Agueda Yaunmaize was convicted of impeding the prosecution of Antra Ozzolina's murderer, knowing or believing Roman to have committed the killing. As the verdict was read, Agueda's shoulders slumped. While she was not convicted of harming Antra directly, the jury did not accept that her fear absolved her of her responsibility. In their view, whatever the abuse she had suffered, she had still chosen to lie repeatedly and in doing so had obstructed the course of justice. At the sentencing hearing in late February 2018, Mr. Justice Patrick McCarthy addressed the court. He acknowledged the complexity of the case. On one hand, Agueda had committed a serious offence by staging the scene of a murder to appear to be that of a suicide and lying to Gardaí, an offence that carried a potential sentence of up to 10 years in prison. On the other, he recognised that she had endured extreme and terrifying circumstances that mitigated her culpability. The judge described Agueda as one of life's victims and noted the evidence that she had been in an abusive relationship marked by extreme aggression from Roman Panamarkas. He referred to psychiatric reports, confirming her post-traumatic stress disorder and long-standing vulnerability. He also noted her work history in Ireland and the absence of any previous criminal record, describing her not as an habitual offender, but as someone caught in an appalling situation. Justice McCarthy stated that there was little doubt that the man who could undoubtedly be described as the murderer was an abusive partner. Nevertheless, he said, the jury had been entitled to hold Agueda fully responsible for her actions. While Roman Panamarkas was the true killer, Agueda still had to face consequences for helping him conceal the crime. He sentenced Agueda Yaunmaize to 3 years in prison, backdated to account for time already served in custody. It was a sentence well below the maximum available. Agueda accepted the sentence, and by mid-2021 she was a free woman, having served her time. No one is ever likely to be convicted of Antra Ozzolina's murder. In official terms, it remains a homicide without a prosecutable killer. Roman Panamarkas will live out his days in a nursing home, severely disabled and unaware of the proceedings that unfolded in his name. To some, Roman's fate is a form of grim poetic justice. To Antra's family, it denied them the closure of seeing her killer held to account in a courtroom. For them, there would be no verdict for murder. Only the knowledge of what had happened and the absence of formal justice. For the people of Killinalec, Antra Ozzolina's death left a lasting mark on the community. Without that community and their determination that she should get justice, we may never have known her story. The case also exposed how violence, fear, and coercive control can pull people into acts they might never otherwise commit. It showed how a crime can ripple outward, destroying more than one life. Above all, it underscored the importance of persistence. Had Gardaí accepted the scene at face value, backed up by the first autopsy which showed nothing untoward had happened? Had friends not voiced their doubts? Had the forensic evidence not been scrutinised? Antra's death might have been recorded as a suicide. The truth would have been buried with her. Instead, the evidence spoke, and through it, Antra Ozzolina's story was finally told. Her killer, while not behind bars, did not escape unpunished. Thank you for listening to this episode of Lines of Inquiry. If you're enjoying the podcast, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating or review. We have now passed 1,500 5-star ratings on Spotify, with a growing number of reviews on Apple Podcasts. Thank you. These reviews help new people discover the podcast. We are reading every comment, and we genuinely appreciate the time you take to share your thoughts. Please keep them coming. If you're listening on Spotify, please leave a comment below on this episode. Let us know what you think. You can also get in touch with us directly by emailing linesofinquiry@goloudnow.com. We'll be reading your emails in an episode of Case Notes in the coming weeks. That's our new second strand of this podcast, available here as well. Lines of Inquiry is presented by me, John Sweetman. The podcast is created by Darren Cleary. Our executive producer is Owen Brennan. Siobhan Walsh and Siobhan Maguire are our producers. This episode was written by Darren Cleary and edited by Owen Brennan and myself. Sound design and editing by Neil Kavanagh. Legal, marketing and social media support comes from the team at Go Loud. If you would like to support the series, we'd really appreciate it. Please share it with a friend on WhatsApp, post it to your social media, or simply recommending it to someone you know, it makes a real difference. Join me next time as we open another case and follow the evidence wherever it leads. Because, in the end, everything done in the dark comes to light.